This afternoon, I'd like to start out lab with a discussion of lab abort number 3, because there have been several questions that have come up, both in office hours and in lecture in the chat windows and in email. And what I'd like to start with are the different equations that you're going to end up using. And this was prompted by a question that came up this morning, which was this. So according to the guidelines, you're supposed to come up with a prototype and a substituted equation for each type of calculation that you do. And so someone was asking, do we need to do this for this lab? And the answer is yes, but that's not as many equations as you might think it is. There's lots of data. There are lots of calculations. There's not that many types of calculations. So just to give you one example, you know that one of the first things you need to do in order to come up with anything in any of the parts of the lab is to calculate rate. And rate is a very simple expression, which is a constant divided by time. Now, that constant doesn't change. The only thing that's going to change is time. So suppose you have parts A and B of the reaction, which is where we're trying to come up with the rate law. And so we want to calculate all those different rates. The data that you are given have 2 trials. So that means you're going to have 8 times 2, which is 16 different rates that you're going to calculate for parts A and B. But you only need to give one example equation. It's not that it has to be one example equation for each part of the lab, one example equation for each substance. No, if you're doing the same calculation over and over again, just show that one calculation once. So it turns out for parts A and B of the lab, there really are only 4 equations that you have to worry about. And like I said, in the way that we discussed it, the first one was rate. And if you review the notes, that equation does end up being R is equal to 0.00036 divided by T. No, you don't have to explain where that comes from in your lab report. Now, it's possible in your lab quiz I might ask something about that, only because that was part of our lab discussion. But for the lab report, you just use the equation. So as I said, there are going to be 16 rates that you calculate. And that's based off of the fact that you have 8 reactions. So reactions 1 through 8. And then trials 1 and 2. Now, the next thing you do, at least in the progression we did, is to come up with the order. And whether it's A or B, the expression is the same. It's the natural log of 2 different reaction rates divided by the natural log of 2. Now, I added a note here where I said sequential reactions. What that means is this. In part A, you do reactions 1 through 4, but then to come up with the order parameter, you're going to compare reaction 1 with reaction 2, reaction 2 with reaction 3, and reaction 3 with reaction 4. So in other words, I said 4A, you're going to compare 1 and 2, 2 and 3, and then 3 and 4. Now again, there's 2 trials, and so that means there's going to be 6 comparisons, because there are 3 pairs that I just listed above, and like I said, the 2 trials. Now, one very important small detail. In the lab procedure, it says to average together the times for the 2 trials. I don't think you get the same mathematical result if you do that. I couldn't think quickly enough in my head this morning when I was trying to rationalize my way through. So for the moment, that's why I'm saying there's six comparisons. You don't average the times together. You're going to average everything at the end, like I will say momentarily. Well, that's for part A. The same thing is going to happen for part B, where you're coming up with the B order parameter. And just to help remind you, the format of the rate law is K times concentration of I minus raised to the A power times peroxydisulfate raised to the B power. We already happen to know that both of those numbers are 1. So, and that's why I kind of skimmed over what are A and B. They're the orders for the rate law. So for A, the only thing that you're changing is the iodide concentration, and that's in reactions 1 through 4. So as I was about to write here, for B, it's going to be comparing reactions 5 through 8. So more specifically, 5 versus 6, 6 and 7, and then 7 and 8. And one more time, that means there's going to be 6 comparisons, 3 pairs, 2 trials. So, to put it explicitly, complete calculations for each trial separately. Then average the two trials. Then round at the end. So because I pushed us on to equilibrium and such, we never did talk about the possibility of reactions with fractional reaction order. But I'll just tell you, it's not a decimal in this lab. It really is going to be a whole number. And I've already told you that number should end up being 1. So you calculate all the rates. And then you're going to have the rates that you use to come up with these order parameters. And because you're comparing things in pairs, that's why there's a total of 12 comparisons, not 16. Now, at the end of that, 6 of the comparisons are going to give you values of A. You average all of them together. Then 6 of them are going to give you the values for B, and you average all those together. And that's going to give you the rate law. The last thing you have to do, then, is the calculations do want you to come up with a rate constant. And we did discuss how to do that. So, for the rate constant, we do need the concentrations used. And so that brings us to our third equation that we're going to need, which is dilution. Because remember, you mix several things together, so whatever the concentration on the bottle was is not the concentration that ended up in the reaction tube. So, whichever reagent it is, the concentration that was used is equal to the volume of the substance used divided by the total volume, and then that's multiplied by the stock concentration. So in part A, where you're doing reactions 1 through 4, the only thing that changes is the iodide. So you have 4 different iodide concentrations, and then there's 1 constant peroxydisulfate concentration. In part B, it's the backwards case. You have changing amount of peroxydisulfate each trial, constant amount of iodide each trial. So there's 5 concentrations in each half. And the concentrations are the same. Wait, what did I just say? There's five concentrations in each part, part A and part B. That's 10 total, and they're the same whether you're talking about trial one or trial two. So there's 10 dilutions that you have to do. Again, since the dilution equation is the same no matter what the substance, you only need to show one example dilution. And again, that's same in both trials. So once we come up with all those concentrations, then the last equation we need for this rate law determination is to come up with a rate constant. So if you take the rate law that I have up above, the general one, if we already know that A and B are supposed to be first order, then we know that we can calculate the rate constant by taking the rate and dividing it by the concentration of the two reagents used, the iodide and the peroxydisulfate. So that means there's 16 rate constants. Because you have 8 reactions, 2 trials. And you're going to average all 16 constants together. Because if you're doing the same reaction at the same temperature, regardless of concentration, the rate constant should be the same. And so you therefore average all the rate constants, whether it's trial one or trial two, whether it's part A or part B. And so the goal of this whole section is to come up with the rate law with K. So this whole discussion was for parts A and B. Kind of warm out there today. So now, some other questions that came up this morning. Can we just follow the format that's in the procedure in the back, the tables that are in the back of the lab text? No and yes. No, because remember, you can't just fill the numbers in, scan that, and submit that as your report. You actually need to write out something yourself. But we did the same calculations that are in the back of the lab procedure. The only major difference is that I said, do not average times together, handle them separately. And that's because without being able to think through it fast enough in my head, I believe it would make a difference in the results you get, whether you calculate the trials separately or you average like that. So I still need to work through that to figure that out. Now, another question that came up about formatting, because there's obviously this is going to be a lot easier with a spreadsheet. So someone essentially asked, well, can we just turn in a spreadsheet that has all of our calculations? That's a bit backwards from the way that documents are normally generated. Normally in a lab report, you have a word processing document that you'll put spreadsheet bits into. But it's a little bit backwards to have a big spreadsheet with a bunch of tables and then equations and text here and there throughout the spreadsheet. So no, you wouldn't really just submit a spreadsheet, but you would have, like for the rates, you have 16 different rates. So you might have your prototype and example equation for just one trial, and then list the results you get from your 16 different reactions. You might put them in an 8x2 format, you know, trial one, trial two, and then show the 8 different reactions. you might get creative because maybe you'll try to set something up in your table where you put the order comparisons along with it, or where you put dilutions, or, you know, there's lots of different ways you can handle the data in this case. But the main point is this. No, don't just submit one, don't just submit one spreadsheet. Do still submit something in a proper, typical document format. So any questions on this? Because I know not necessarily everybody started, but remember, this is going to be due Wednesday of next week. So that means you do still have Monday to be able to ask questions. So I'm just really encouraging, and I'm hoping that you all will get to this sooner than later. Let's move on then to the part C of the lab, which I'll summarize very quickly because we don't really have any new equations except for one that shows up in part C. So remember, part C, that's where we're trying to determine activation energy. Now, this is for the same reaction, so the rate law is already known. So we're not trying to calculate any order parameters like A or B in the part C here. So there are four reactions that are done. So that means there's four rates that you have to calculate. And there's only one trial given. The reason you have to measure four rates is because the reaction is run at four different temperatures. And temperature has a direct effect, as we know from the Arrhenius expression, on a rate constant. Now, like I said, and let me just put it explicitly here, there are no A or B calculations. Because the rate law is already known. Now, all the concentrations in this portion of the experiment are identical in each of the reactions because the only thing we are changing is temperature. And they might even be two of the same values that you calculated in a previous reaction in part A or part B. So whether you can creatively refer back to previous calculations or just to redo them quickly here, there's a total of two dilutions. And that's, again, because the concentrations are the same. In all reactions. So we have four rates, and that means we're going to come up with four rate constants. Oops. And what you do then is generate a graph. It's the natural log of the rate constant on the y-axis, 1 over temperature on the x-axis. That'll generate a linear graph with a negative slope. And the slope of that graph is going to be equal to negative activation energy divided by r. So the only new equation here is to calculate for activation energy. Which is where Ea is equal to negative mr, where m in this case is just the slope, and r is the thermodynamic constant 8.314. we're going to go ahead and move on to discussing, or finish discussing, the lab about indicators. Now, we're not going to be doing calculations in the sense we're not going to write our lab report for this. And that's because I feel that the usefulness of this experiment would be much greater in doing it. Because as you're going to see, the way that I do the calculations, very different than the way it's written in the lab procedure. It's a little mathematical trickery that gives you very easy results. So that's why we're not going to do it, because it's too easy to worth us all going through the effort of doing it. But I want you to understand the theory behind it. That part's important. So, a concept that I might not have directly stated the other day, but is something that will come up in Chem 1C, is this. Indicators normally change color. When the pH equals the pKa. Since this is the point at which the concentrations of the indicator and its conjugate are equal. Now, we had worked up to this point of talking about pH equals pKa by doing a little bit of math trick, which came from a definition of the Ka. And actually, if you can think in your head, Ka is equal to H plus times A minus over HA. Well, if A minus and HA are the same, then that equation becomes H plus concentration equals Ka. Turn that into a log expression, and you get pH equals pKa. And I said we could arrive there if somehow we ended up with equal amounts of these two concentrations. But it works in the other direction too. Because what if you had already a solution fixed at this pH where it's equal to the pKa? Then that's approximately going to force there to be equal amounts of these two different forms of the indicator. Well, the two different forms are two different colors. So if you got half of one and half of the other, it makes sense that's the point where you can start seeing a color change really occur. And this is, again, a concept you'll come back to next quarter in determining what is the best indicator for a particular titration. But so that was just a quick statement about indicators. And now here's the point, really. I just said that if we can get to this point where the concentrations of the indicator and its conjugate are equal, that's where the pH equals the pKa, and the goal of this lab is to come up with the strength, the pKa of that acid. Well, we could eyeball it, meaning literally just look and see, well, where is it green? Because yellow plus blue makes green. But we could use spectroscopy to see how much yellow, the acidic form, there is, or how much blue, the basic form, there is. And that's why I like this experiment, because spectroscopy is a critically important technique in chemistry. If you end up in being a chemistry major or doing much in science, you cannot get away from spectroscopy. So, the acidic form, the one that has the proton, remember that is yellow, which I know I'm writing in orange, but here's what yellow looks like. And if you can see that, well, you can't tell that the iPad's frozen. Okay, and now if you can see that, it probably made your eyes hurt, and you all are younger than me. but not very visible, that yellow. That's the point I'm making here. Now, blue, I could do that. So the basic form, the one where you take the hydrogen off, the deprotonated form, that is blue. Now, I don't want to get very deep into the topic today. I just want to put it out there to confuse everybody, which is this. The acidic solution, which is yellow, when we do spectroscopy, it's not going to look yellow according to the spectrometer. Meaning that if the substance itself is yellow, it's because that's what it's not absorbing. So as far as the color we're going to detect, like where does the absorption occur, it's not in the region of the spectrum where you find yellow, it's going to be blue. And the reverse is going to be true for the basic form. Visibly, the thing is blue. That means that it does not absorb blue light. It absorbs some other color of light, which happens to be orangish. And this is due to what is known as the color wheel. There are what are known as complementary colors. And without practicing it, that's one of the few topics I really, really, really avoid. Mainly because I can't just do it from the seat of my pants like most topics. So since I haven't taught 1C in a while, I'm not up in my color wheel theory at the moment. But I'm just saying that to make you realize when I write these spectra out, I don't have them backwards. It's this effect that whatever color you see is not the color being absorbed. So the one that looks yellow has a spectrum that looks like this. Spectrum just like what we did in the equilibrium lab, where we took a sample and we measured its absorbance between 370 and 700 nanometers. And it turns out the maximum absorbence, the wavelength of maximum absorbance for this acidic form is 460 nanometers. Now, the blue form is interesting because it has two peaks, a small one and a major one. There we go. And it has a lambda max, which one moment, for some reason, I didn't write that down this morning. Look it up. +620. Again, towards the orange side of the spectrum. Now, let's put the two graphs on top of each other so I can make an important point. Because I said earlier, well, we could eyeball where green happens. You know, figure out where it looks green, and you could say, oh, that's about equal amounts of yellow and blue. And I said use spectroscopy to do it because that would be a better technique. Yeah, only if this is true. That where the two compounds interact with light, oh darn it, are two different regions of the spectrum. If these graphs overlapped with each other more, like let's say that you look for the substances at a point where these graphs cross each other. Well, where they cross, that means they both react to the light at that wavelength. So you couldn't tell which compound is which. But notice that where the yellow form happens to absorb most strongly, that is not really in a region where the blue compound responds. And same thing other way around. Where the blue form of the indicator responds, then you don't really have much of the yellow form having absorption there. And that is close to ideal behavior. Ideal behavior would be where this is even narrower, where there's even less overlap between the two spectra. But in other words, this is not bad. And that's why the lab works. So in order to for the two substances to be separately detectable, I say two substances. In order for the two conjugates to be separately detectable, they must absorb light at completely different regions of the spectrum. And to a reasonable enough degree, they're separate enough for this lab. So again, this is similar to what we did with the discussion of the equilibrium constant lab. Well, first we had to figure out how it behaved, and then we could scan it. So here's the type of data we would get. Because now we know which wavelength to look for, and so now we get down to what we really care about. What pH is it that we see equal amounts of the two forms of the indicator? So now our x-axis is going to be pH. And the way that you do that is you create a series of buffers, all different pH systems. And you throw a little bit of indicator into each system. And here's what we get. It makes sense that you get the most absorbance for the acidic form when we're at really low pH, when we're in a really acidic mixture. And the base form, it makes sense, it reaches its maximum concentration when we're in a really basic mixture. Now, we could use this graph to come up with concentrations. And the only thing is, there are two different extinction coefficients. Because notice that the blue form is more sensitive to light, period, than the acidic form is, at equal concentration. So what the reason I'm drawing the dotted lines is just to highlight that the two conjugates have different extinction coefficients. Which would be the epsilon.
He's frozen.
Oh, darn it. Yes, it is. One moment. There we go. Extinction coefficient. Remember, that's the thing in Beer's law that tells us how sensitive a compound is to a particular frequency or wavelength of light. And here's where I bring the point up. We could go through the process of calculating concentrations, finding out where they're equal. Or there's another mathematical trick we could do, which is we change the axes for one of the graphs. And one way to do that is to take the graph for the acid form and multiply it by a factor to get it to the point where its maximum absorbance period is the same as the base form. And it's frozen again. And this is a process called normalization. But once we do it, all we have to do is find out now where the two graphs cross. Because if their y-axes are the same, then where they cross, they have the same concentration. And so that's where the pH is equal to the pKa. And again, that pKa that is the strength of the indicator, which is the goal of the lab.